This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
A new paper warns high heat and humidity will become deadly over the next decades as the climate shifts. Well, as American novelist William Gibson said, the future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed. Another paper, just released in Science Advances, says lethal pockets of heat are already appearing in some countries, including the United States. The title is The Emergence of Heat and Humidity Too Severe for Human Tolerance. From Columbia University's Earth Institute, we have reached co-author Dr. Radley Horton. He is an associate research professor at the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, a convening lead for the U.S. National Climate Assessment, and serves on numerous climate task forces with a long list of important scientific papers, which I've looked over. Radley Horton, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for the chance to be here today.
We just interviewed Timothy Lenton about his new paper in Nature. They showed the climate niche, as they call it, preferred by humans, will shift during the next decades. Some places will become uninhabitable. Maybe we'll see mass migration of over a billion people. In 2017, you co-authored an article on projections for a rapid rise in global excess heat stress exposure, and you predicted that for mid to late century. What made your team wonder if that future is already here?
So I think the main thing that made us wonder if we needed to revisit the analysis has to do with the issue of spatial scales. In our 2017 paper, we were largely relying on what we call grid boxes, this sort of gridded scale, you know, maybe a 50-mile by 50-mile box, for example. And we were averaging conditions across that whole box. And we realized that in the real world, we might need to hone in at much finer spatial scales, such as the coastal cities where people live in high density, and see if some of these humid heat extremes might be much greater if we looked at a specific point and a shorter period of time. That was the primary motivation. And then a broader motivation was our earlier study had relied really solely on climate model projections. And in addition to this issue that climate models rely on averaging across these bigger areas, there's also a chance that climate models may miss some critical processes that could become important as the planet warms.
So how do we know what the limits of the human body are?
That's a great question. There's really a paradox here when we talk about humid heat. On the one hand, there is a known threshold where really anybody, even someone who's in perfect health, sitting in the shade with an endless supply of water, not exerting themselves, simply can't sweat fast enough, efficiently enough to avoid overheating. And that threshold is somewhere around what we call a wet bulb temperature of 35 degrees Celsius or 95 degrees Fahrenheit. So there is a cliff, if you will, over which theoretically it's basically impossible for a person thermodynamically to stay cool outside. But while that threshold is interesting and important from a research perspective, there's a simultaneous reality, which is that real people have pre-existing health conditions. Some of them are elderly. Some of them need to be doing heavy-duty labor, whether it's agricultural work, farming, construction, outdoors. And depending on those people's health and how hard they're laboring, they're going to experience this danger threshold at much lower combinations of temperature and humidity than that 35 degrees Celsius wet bulb I mentioned earlier. So there is a threshold above which no one can really survive, but there are also these sort of rolling thresholds, depending on the actual vulnerability of people, that are at much lower combinations of temperature and humidity, but that vary.
Well, frankly, the whole concept of a sliding scale of temperature and humidity is pretty hard for the public to grasp. In Canada, meteorologists call it the Humidex Index. That's what we see on TV weather reports here. And American weathercasters talk about the heat index, but that's based on something different. And I don't know what it is in Europe or India or what scientists call it for sure. If this is a matter of life and death, why is it all so confusing?
The main reason it's confusing, I think, is because We're moving into conditions that are so far outside of the human experience. And when people have come up with these indices like the heat index, they've tended to tailor them more locally to what people are used to experiencing. And what's frightening about our paper is that we look at these really extreme combinations of temperature and humidity. They're basically off the chart. When the heat index was defined, it was defined for a world, a combination of temperature and humidity that is being exceeded more and more often in more and more places. And the effects are very nonlinear. So, you know, when temperatures are already high, when humidity is already high, if you turn that dial just a little bit higher, as the increase in greenhouse gases due to human activity do, you get a big increase in risk to people, big fall offs in people's ability to work productively outdoors.
Well, I guess we just have to learn some of the symptoms so we'll know when it is dangerous, because we can't always rely on even the weather report to predict it accurately.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that measures you mentioned, you know, are very helpful. You know, when we see these heat warnings, for example, we know that we may not want our young people doing sports activities outdoors. We may know to take extra precautions. But it is true that because of some of these nonlinearities in the definitions, it's hard to come up with a number that everybody understands for what temperature plus humidity means. Of course, it's easy to understand a temperature reading, right? If you're just focused on temperature, we can just, you know, look at the thermometer. It's easy to understand. But as we start to bring in the humidity, it's critically important, but a little harder to quantify in a way that everybody can understand.
From my interviews with previous guests, including Camila Mora and Alex DeSherbinin, we know that heat deaths are poorly recorded. The actual cause on the death certificate might be heart attack or something else. I wonder, how big a danger is this? For example, do you think more people might die annually from excess heat and humidity than have died so far from COVID-19?
I don't know the answer to that question, but I think your overall point is absolutely right, that heat deaths go way under-recorded. A lot of people with pre-existing health conditions, whether it's heart condition, respiratory issues, renal disease, they don't show up, as you noted, on death certificates as being heat-related. But if we go back and look at the records for cities around the world, we do absolutely see that, you know, when temperatures tend to be really high, there are a higher number of deaths.
And your co-author Tom Matthews published a paper in PNAS in 2017 where that team found at least 350 million more megacity inhabitants will be afflicted by mid-century by this. So whether we know it or not, the coming heat is a threat to megacities as well as rural areas. Is that true?
Absolutely. You know, we worry about people because they tend to be concentrated often in near coastal zones, which tend to be low elevation. Low elevation, you know, can get that much warmer. There are also tendency for lower air quality, which can introduce simultaneous risks associated with the heat, with the air quality being poor at the same times. And as we're thinking about extreme humid heat, the ocean, which we tend to think of maybe as providing relief from the heat, paradoxically can make things worse. If that nearby water body is really, really warm, when the breeze is blowing towards that coastal city, it may actually make conditions worse. That's one of the findings from our paper. When we look at some of the pretty big cities of the Persian Gulf region, Dhahran, Saudi Arabia, for example, and other areas of the Red Sea and Persian Gulf. So, yes, lots of vulnerability in cities. But I think for a lot of rural regions, this is going to be a growing risk, too. As temperatures rise and humidity gets higher, some of those places, for example, in the U.S. and parts of Canada, where maybe in the past you could get by without air conditioning, you're going to find more and more sort of oppressive evenings where you don't get that sort of natural cooling down that lets the body and other systems kind of reset.
So these killer conditions could appear out on the ocean and we would never record it.
Well, I'll tell you something we found from our study. We looked at the water temperatures in the Persian Gulf region, and we found that in 2017, for the first time, even when we look at those larger sort of grid box scales that I mentioned earlier, some of those coastal waters crossed this 35 degrees Celsius 95-degree Fahrenheit threshold for the first time. And that is an additional line of evidence these conditions can occur, because if the water's getting that warm, the atmosphere directly above it can take up those exact same properties of high temperature and high humidity.
Well, let's get to some of the specifics in your new paper in Science Advances. What do you call these deadly heat events, and where have they already appeared, say, in the United States?
So when the wet bulb temperatures are really high, you know, we see a whole series of major impacts. The worst wet bulb events, you know, when we crossed or approached that 35 degree Celsius threshold of lethal heat and humidity for anybody, even someone who's in perfect health, some of the big risk there is coastal cities in the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia. But interestingly, we also found some values right up around that 35 Celsius threshold across Pakistan, even to some extent inland from the ocean. So we think that's some combination of the winds being able to blow off the ocean, but potentially also some interactions with the fact that the land is irrigated there. Possibly the land itself is providing a source of moisture to go with those very high temperatures. So that's where you see the highest values of all. But as we looked at other areas, such as Gulf of California, Sea of Cortez, and the area just inland from there, parts of the Northwest Australia, we also saw wet bulb temperatures not quite as high, but getting up to, say, 33 degrees Celsius, 31 degrees Celsius, which, as I noted earlier, for anyone, elderly, pre-existing health conditions, you know, really going to suffer if they don't have access to air conditioning. It's going to be really hard to do any kind of outdoor labor for a prolonged period of time. The values across the United States and Canada, for the most part, don't get quite as high. The worst events we've seen in that region, somewhere on the order of 30 degrees Celsius, 31 degrees Celsius. Those types of values might happen once every few years across, say, parts of Louisiana. And what's interesting is we also found instances even further north, as far up as Wisconsin, of wet bulb temperatures somewhere around 30 degrees Celsius.
So it's kind of a sliding scale. I mean, we've talked about 35 C, which is 95 Fahrenheit, but even 30 or 31 on this scale could be dangerous to human health?
Without question. I'd say anything above even 26 degrees Celsius could be very dangerous for human health. People who, you know, might live in a city like Toronto, somewhere like Chicago, Boston, their sort of worst humid heat event that you might experience in a typical year or every 3 years, that's going to be a value that's well below 30 degrees. You know, it could be more like 27, 28 on that wet bulb scale. So it doesn't sound like a high number, but that's that day when people are at a huge risk of heat stroke. If you're, say, a construction worker, you're going to need to take extra precautions for sure. Not be out during the most extreme temperatures, take a lot of breaks, and consider postponing that work if possible.
It's interesting you say that, because one expert explained that there is a different heat tolerance for people, say, in Britain than there is for somebody who lives in the Mediterranean all the time, and they expect it. And people actually react physiologically differently according to what they're acclimatized to. And look, in 2003, deadly heat killed at least 30,000 people in Europe, with very high totals in France. Did that event meet your criteria, including the humidity factor?
You know, it did, but it highlights that even a little bit lower values are dangerous. The wet bulb temperatures were on the order of about 26 degrees Celsius, depending on where you look, during that 2003 event. So again, that number may not sound very high, but yeah, as you said, 30 to, you know, maybe as many 50,000 people passed away. And you're right that it does differ depending on the region. Some of that probably has to do with physiology. We know, for example, that the first heat wave of the year in a given location tends to be more deadly than when you hit those same temperatures later in the season. There's probably a little bit of people's human, you know, body response to that. But then there's also other factors to think about, like who has access to air conditioning? What's the air quality like? Is there a support network, you know, to look out for people who might be suffering? What's the sort of capacity of the state and institutions to help people in need? Are there forecasts, you know, made available, issued, and is the information communicated to people? Those are some of the other factors that are going to help influence just how vulnerable people are.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Radley Horton from Columbia University. We are discussing new science about the early arrival of deadly heat. A report last year from David Hassemeyer at Inside Climate News revealed U.S. military members have already died from excess heat. Radley, beyond the military, and you mentioned this a little bit, what other workers are at high risk as novel climate conditions appear more and more often?
I think, you know, just about everybody is the answer to that. Certainly something we're really concerned about, you know, as we look at parts of South Asia, for example, that are going to see these really high values. What's going to happen to the farmers toiling out in the fields for hours? How are they going to be affected? How are people who might have like renal conditions going to be affected in the future? That's a big concern. There were some studies out of Central America in the last few years indicating that some outdoor laborers were suffering severe kidney conditions. So that sort of thing needs further looking at. But there's also, of course, a lot of people who may not be outdoors, but are they working in an air-conditioned environment? So this could be factory workers, textile workers. You have to think about those groups as too. But there's so much we don't understand. Even, for example, how is academic performance, students' ability to learn, going to be affected by these high temperatures and high humidities? You know, my suspicion, which is really just an intuition, since I'm a climate scientist, not a medical expert, is that as we look deeper, we'll find that just about any sector, any kind of walk of life is going to be affected by this kind of extreme humid heat. And of course, it extends beyond people, too. I think we need more research on the implications for other large mammals. How are moose going to be affected? Bear, just to give a couple other examples.
Are we getting more of these extreme events? Has the number of deadly combinations increased since the 1970s?
This was really our biggest takeaway from the paper, to my mind. You're absolutely right. When we looked at the data since about 1980 or so, it almost doesn't matter which wet bulb threshold you pick. You could pick 27, 29, 31, 33, strong upward trends globally in the number of occurrences. Think something on the order of a doubling of the frequency of these dangerous events, just really in the last 40 years or so. So that's, of course, consistent with one of the simplest but most important and maybe underappreciated takeaways of climate change, that when we hear about these small shifts in average conditions, the 1 degree Celsius of global warming, the less than 1 foot, you know, barely a quarter of a meter of sea level rise, these things kind of sound like nothing, arguably. But when you go look at what they mean for the frequency of extremes, the changes are profound. The small shift in the mean can give us a huge shift in the frequency of certain types of extremes, and it opens the door to these kind of unprecedented extremes that our society is not adapted for, that our key infrastructure wasn't built, you know, for, and that's exactly where we see the biggest sort of nonlinear societal vulnerabilities. The temperature is 20 Celsius. Doesn't really matter if it goes up 1 degree, but if the temperature on a given day is 38 Celsius, just temperature alone I'm talking about here, and that goes up by 1 degree, huge impact on the amount of demand for air conditioning, the risk of the power grid going out, huge impact on crops if this is happening at the wrong time in a crop cycle, and huge impact on how many people are going to end up in the hospital.
Yes, we've talked about heat deaths, but it's my understanding if a person experiences heat stroke, it may not be fatal at all, but there could be some lasting health impacts. Did you run across that?
That's outside of my area of expertise, but I suspect you're absolutely right. We've been talking about deaths, but there's all the people who just end up having to go to the hospital. And then, of course, once they're in the hospital, that can lead to additional complications. But I suspect that you're right along the entire pathway that, you know, having a health outcome, negative health outcome, can put certain vulnerable people on a trajectory that they may not be able to recover from. And who knows, maybe even when we go and look, you know, earlier at how young people may be affected by extreme humid heat. What about before babies are born? How is birth weight and various other outcomes affected by whether a mother is exposed to extreme temperature and humidity? There's a little bit of research on these areas, but I think a lot more is needed. And to me, it's entirely intuitive what you're suggesting, which is that, you know, even if it doesn't kill you, it could set up some longer term negative outcomes.
Well, even if it doesn't kill you, we certainly need to be researching all these things you just mentioned because we're living on a planet that's heating up. One thing I know for sure is one of the strange symptoms of heat stroke is confusion. People may not realize they are in danger. They may not seek shelter or help. And in a way, we're already in that position with all of global warming. Don't you think we're in danger, but we're not really seeking shelter or help?
That's a really interesting analogy. I hadn't thought about it that way. I think that's right. We're all kind of, stumbling around in these unprecedented circumstances. And it's, we're not necessarily acting. It looks like we're not acting, you know, in our best interest. And I think it's really important, just on a more sort of basic level, your point that, as these vulnerabilities rise, we can't assume that individuals will necessarily be able to recognize all the symptoms. So if you're a construction company, for example, thinking about your workers' exposure, it's great to educate the individuals, but also everybody needs to be looking out for each other because, as you know, as you start to become disoriented, you know, feel ill, there might be sort of direct risks of, who knows, falling, equipment you might be using. So we can't just assume that everyone will be able to sort of make the right decision or know how to react. And I think that is kind of a, as you know, kind of a powerful analogy for sort of where we are as a society and facing these unprecedented risks.
Well, you mentioned rising seas, and I know you published on that. And in one presentation, you explained the possible impacts of sea levels going up 6 feet by the end of this century. That's about 2 meters, a little less. So far, we haven't seen sea level rise that would add up to that. Should we expect rising oceans to increase the pace?
I think we should expect rising oceans to increase the pace. I think that's almost bound to happen. Basically, the climate system is out of equilibrium. We're dumping so many greenhouse gases in the atmosphere that greenhouse gas concentrations are rising quickly. And the more quickly they rise, the further the climate system and the ice sheets are from equilibrium. So as we turn that dial up, the rate of sea level rise should increase. The big question is, how quickly will that rate of increase rise? I think we can't rule out an upper bound of 2 meters by the end of this century. If you're taking a risk management approach, if you're responsible for a nuclear power plant potentially in a flood zone, or if you're building some critical infrastructure that has to last 100 years, military applications, I think you want to think about that upper end scenario. But I find more and more I'm actually emphasizing in a lot of my talks the lower end scenarios, not because I think they're more likely, but because I really want to convey to people that even if things somehow broke in our favor and we didn't see as much sea level rise as we could, if we somehow only have 2 feet of sea level rise this century, a little over half a meter, I think it's likely to be more than that. But I try to convey to people that even if it were just that lower end scenario, the impacts are going to be so profound on our society. Think about coastal flooding, whether it's sort of nuisance flooding or those 1-in-100-year catastrophic flood events where you can't get insurance above that level. We find those events with just a couple feet of sea level rise in some coastal cities in the U.S. could be happening almost 100 times more often than they did in the past. So that essentially means what used to be that 1-in-100-year high water mark could be the event that you experience every year or two, even if things break our way and we get relatively little sea level rise, and even if storms don't become any stronger, which of course is a big if. A lot of research suggests, storms will get stronger. So we're locked into huge changes in the frequency and intensity of coastal flooding, even if we don't get that extreme sea level scenario. But of course, from a precautionary approach, knowing how vulnerable we are, we absolutely need to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions dramatically so that we can do everything possible to rule out the feedbacks that could lead us on that really dangerous trajectory of, say, you know, more than 2 feet of sea level rise.
I'm still a bit stuck on the way to understand how lethal heat arrives. It pops up in a few places now and then, perhaps only for a few hours or a couple of hot days. How do we get from there to a much more dangerous world outside? Will there be startling events or just a slow boiling of the frog?
Yeah, great question. I think to really unpack that, we need more research on the almost forensics of these really extreme humid heat events of the past. I think we need more research on what was experienced in, whether it's southern Iran or the coast of the Persian Gulf. It's not always easy to get that data about the meteorology, but also about how people were affected. So I think that's the first thing we need to understand. But the overall kind of typical setup, I think, that may make some of these coastal regions in the Persian Gulf particularly vulnerable is the idea that maybe temperatures are able to creep up based on winds flowing from the land, the nearby deserts. Based on our quick look at the data, it appears that you get the really lethal heat humidity when the winds then shift and flow for an extended period of time over those very warm waters. Maybe those coastal cities somehow are just the right or just the worst spot to get the blend of the high temperatures from the land and mixing with that humidity. But it's going to be a different flavor in different places. I mentioned earlier that we also see instances of this extreme humid heat making its way up through India, up through Pakistan to some of those, the base of some of those mountain ranges. So we need more research there for sure. The conditions are going to differ, but some common features, definitely something to look for, I think, in the future. What if our climate models miss some of those worst-case scenarios of how high water temperatures can get? If that's the case, and this is something I think we need to look at, we may be looking at a blind spot when we go to estimate.
Radley Horton, you have shared a lot of your valuable time with us. I really appreciate it. Thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.